Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Bye-Bye Boydie Show because we are sending off yet another Health Matters producer.
Another one bites the dust.
Tanner Boyd, our show's producer for the summer, has found apparently some type of, I'm making air quotes here,
paying gig.
Job.
Yeah.
And decided to desert us.
Tony, we're in radio. It's a gig.
Mid-show. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and here to explain how Tanner can now access the show just like the rest of the world is the manager of communications infrastructure for UK, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. That's right. That's Tanner's former employees. Website, Moorhead State Public Radio. You can find Health Matters in the menu. You can jump over to that page. You'll see a list of the more recent shows. There's a link there if you want to listen to the show. There's a link there to a podcast. Again, if you like having Health Matters delivered to your device automatically, sign up for that podcast. You won't regret it. After that, jump over to Facebook. There you'll start regretting it. It's the way to interact with the show, and you know, sometimes it's better just to say stuff to us because, well, you really don't want to hear us chime back, right, Tony? You don't want us talking to you on Facebook.
It's better to just better to get it rid of.
Ask Larry. I mean, Larry, we can't shut up with Larry. So Larry's like, you know, we just won't leave him alone, right? I mean, everything we do is Larry, 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 Larry.
You know, I thought about naming our Facebook fans the Sons of Larry. It just sounds like a
great... Isn't that's a band. That's a band name. Anyway, Facebook.com, you can certainly jump there. We have a fan page. It's facebook.com/HM Radio Show. Do a search for Health Matters Radio Show. You'll find us there. Send us some show topics. Send us some concerns. Send us what you know about Zika lately. Tony, you can let me give my report at some point this show on my Zika encounters in Miami.
Ricky Zicardo.
There you go. There you go. But anyway, you can do all that with a fan page there at facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Society for Etiquette in the Clinic, reminding you patience is a virtue, but no doctor wants virtual patients. This is from Time Magazine, 9 questions your doctor wishes you would ask. And
who's your doctor?
Yeah, well, that's a question. I got to say, Rick, you know, this comes on the heels of a study that recently indicated for every 1 hour a doctor actually sees a patient and talks to a patient, they spend 2 hours on the computer or filling out forms or doing other paperwork.
Do you think that's accurate?
I believe it is, especially with electronic records.
Does that translate to, is this why your doctor only gives you a 6-minute appointment?
Because
so they only got to spend 12 minutes on the computer?
Yeah, they're going to spend a 20-minute time. And a lot of physicians are doing this in the evening time. These electronic medical records, we've said it over and over again, they are horrible. They are not designed to actually assist a care provider in providing care. They are designed for billing, designed for statistical analysis. They're designed for record keeping, but not for actually taking care of patients. But assuming that you have a doctor who has mastered the electronic medical record, 9 questions, according to Time Magazine, your doctor wishes you'd ask. And I thought some of these were actually pretty good questions, and it would be worthwhile. First question, what are the different treatment options? That is, in many cases, there may be a couple of options that may be close to equal. There may be one that's clearly superior. Some doctors become offended. They say, look, I've picked the best one. You don't need to know about second and third best. I think most physicians, though, if you ask about treatment options, they'll tell you some other options. Everything from fungus in your toenails all the way to having some type of surgery, you have different options, and it's fair enough to ask about that. Question number 2, what outcome should I expect? This is an important one. For instance, if a person's having a joint replacement, will you be able to run, to play softball, to go skiing and things like that? The answer in most cases, especially skiing, is no. But you need to know what you can expect from the surgery, or if the medication is to correct a chronic problem and so forth, what kind of outcome should you expect from that? Question number 3, do we have to do this now or can we revisit it later? In a lot of cases, the patient will have some symptom and I will say, well, here's the test I would recommend or here's the treatment I would try. But it was based on the fact that they had this symptom and it was bothersome to them. This is sometimes if you're having chest pain, I get you to an emergency room right away. No, I don't want you to go back to the emergency room next week. I think you need to go to the emergency room now. But for other chronic conditions, we can allow some time to pass and see what happens. So that's a reasonable question. Do we have to do this now, or can we wait till later? And then question four, and I'll stop there. Is there anything I can do on my own to improve my condition? Wow. I don't think I've ever had anyone ask that question that way. But these are things like lifestyle. If you have something like heartburn and reflux, if you don't lie down immediately after meals, if you avoid caffeine, chocolates, peppermint, things like that, that can help and may reduce your reliance on medication. So I'm sure as a physician, I would love to talk to you about exercise, about diet, about lifestyle, about things like that. And that would be a very good question to ask. We'll stop there with question number four, and we'll continue on with those. Those are the nine questions your doctor wishes you would ask. That's brought to you by the Society for Etiquette in the Clinic. We start off, again, with our salute to Tanner Boyd. We'll make this brief, about as brief as his tenure as a producer.
What did he have, maybe 12 weeks, 10 weeks?
If that much. I mean, it didn't take – you could just see the life draining out of him show after show. It got to the point where, you know, I mean, he just
– I'm surprised the show even got recorded.
Yeah. I don't know how this is going to turn out. If the show ends in the middle, you know that he just couldn't go on. I mean, the guy looked sturdy when he started. We thought he could take punishment. We really,
really
did.
Really. But, you know, the thing is he's been with the radio station a while.
Yeah.
It took us
to force him
off to get him out of here.
Now, admittedly, we have some perks. For instance, we don't like green M&Ms in our dressing room. And admittedly, most radio shows don't have dressing
rooms.
Tony,
you have a dressing room?
Just saying.
I didn't get a dressing room.
Some perks that we had the show.
I think there's unfair treatment going on.
All right, so talking about Tanner Boyd. First of all, Tanner plays guitar and likes a wide range of music. He's played with people at the Center for Traditional Music, right, Tanner? Yeah. But I've also, I visited his Facebook page because that's a fun fact as well. It was the only way I could communicate with him. He seems to have some other musical interests as well. Fun fact number two, big Star Wars fan, but
he's
also... likes slasher movies. Isn't that a little bit weird? You know, you think Star Wars, a vision of hope for the galaxy, and then this one where people just basically get their intros
cut out. You obviously haven't seen Star Wars because they do some slashing in Star Wars.
They cut off hands.
And they make cool sounds when they do it.
Yeah.
Zoom. And then next you know, a guy's in half.
thanks for that visual there, Rick. He got his bachelor's degree multimedia production at Morehead State University.
He graduated?
Did this spring, which may explain the whole paying job focus in his life right now. Did not have a cell phone at the start of the summer. He has joined the ranks of the cell phone owners during the summer. Like stand-up comedy, Yoo-Hoo chocolate drink. And who doesn't like Yoo-Hoo chocolate drink?
Come on. You know, but you know what? When you compare Yoo-Hoo to regular chocolate milk has it hands down.
Yeah, but
Yoo-Hoo's what you settle for Yoo-Hoo when you go to the store and it's all they have.
And like Smoky Valley Truck Stop. And Tanner, a couple of awards. He won the Kentucky Associated Press first place award for best college newscast in 2015.
He'll never get that award again.
Nope, don't think so. And then he did this when he received an honorable mention back in 2012 for the soft news feature. And, you know, we don't do soft news on Health Matters. You know, I mean, it's a little embarrassing,
He's a soft news
producer. That is about all we know about Tanner Boyd.
Hey, if he'd have stayed longer, we might
we
know more.
We would have actually introduced ourselves and met him firsthand.
I'm surprised. If we didn't have it down on the paper, we might not remember what his name was.
Yeah, I know. We got time. Yes, we got time.
You've always got time.
Okay, let me finish this one with a little bit of healthcare information because ostensibly that's what the show is about. This came from Wallet Hub, believe it or not, and it was a
Wallet
piece. Wallet Hub. Yeah, this is what Tanner would call a soft news feature. Wallet Hub to get a little publicity. They ranked the United States in their best in the best and worst healthcare states. So, and where would you expect Kentucky would rank in the ranking of states, best and worst healthcare?
We're going to be in the worst.
Yeah, you would think that. Actually, and this is surprising, Kentucky ranked 36th.
Well, you know, Tony, that's in the bottom half, so I'm not that far off. And the second thing is we have a huge indigent care population, which just recently started getting paid health care, right? So now everybody in the state has health care, right? That has to help something.
I believe it did. Well, I know it helped a couple of the numbers they specified. But let's start. They divided into three things: health care costs, health care access, and healthcare outcomes. Now, healthcare costs, this is the cost of a medical visit, a dental visit, monthly insurance premium, out-of-pocket spending, all those equally weighted, we rank ninth in the nation.
Okay.
We are, in fact, a relatively inexpensive place to get your healthcare.
Well, but again, makes a little bit of sense, right? We have less real estate values. We have, I mean, just in general, the cost of living is less, and so utilities are going to be a little less.
Right, and add to that,
real estate's going to be less.
One in four of Kentucky citizens are on Medicaid, and Medicaid has a fairly low reimbursement rate. But
exactly.
Again, your costs and certainly your out-of-pocket costs on Medicaid are going to be
salaries are going to be less.
Sure.
I mean, overall, health care is going to cost less.
So 36 overall, ninth ranking on health care costs. Next is health care access. Now, you might be surprised to know that we rank 21st. On healthcare access, public hospitals—that
is a little bit that is a little bit surprising. You know, it may have something to do with the fact that we have really three major kind of urban areas, if you count northern Kentucky, and then you know that's basically what a million of our people, and then the other 3 million are scattered. Well, I guess really about 2 million people are in the urban areas, and then the other 2 million are scattered throughout the rural areas. So
I mean, I've heard mostly 40% rural, but you're right. I mean, we're up over certainly up over a million rural, and the access they look at. Hospital beds per capita, and we don't have many per capitas, so that helps. Emergency room wait time, physicians per capita, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, dentists per capita, percentage of medical residents retained, that is, after you go through your medical education, do you, in fact, stay in the state? Medicare acceptance rates, Medicaid acceptance rates, we do pretty well on that in the rural areas. We'll take Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement,
right.
Whereas a lot of suburban areas don't necessarily do that. So you put that together, and we rank 21st in healthcare access.
Not an unreasonable number.
No. So how do we get, we rank ninth in cost and we rank 21st in access. How do we get to 36 overall? We are, in fact, abysmal in outcomes.
Of course. Well, again, makes sense, right? We're very unhealthy.
Yeah.
If that's even possible, can you be very unhealthy? You're either unhealthy or you're not, right?
No, I don't think it's
an absolute. Is there degrees of unhealthy?
Yeah, it's not like being truthful. I mean, it's you can
or unique, right?
Yeah.
So that's the one I always go back to.
Yeah, yeah. No, this one in the case, you can be a little unhealthy or you can be very
unhealthy.
But I
mean, higher diabetes, higher smoking, got lots of lung cancer.
Yeah, the smoking
thing. I mean,
there's
all that stuff that goes with being a Kentucky resident.
Yep. And I'll give you a couple of things where Kentucky factored in. The fewest dentists per capita. West Virginia was at 47, Alabama 48, Kentucky 49, Louisiana 50, and Tennessee was 51. So pretty much these southern states and West Virginia wound up with the fewest dentists per capita. If you want to know the most dentists, if you want to know the most anything per capita, it's Massachusetts. They had the most dentists. They had the most physicians. They had the lowest percent of adults without a dental visit and so forth. Kentucky also, this was interesting, we were tied for first in the nation, fewest percent of at-risk adults without a routine doctor visit in the past 2 years. We were tied with West Virginia. So apparently, if you are at risk for illness, you will see your doctor in Kentucky and West Virginia. The problem is it won't do a lot of good, but you'll still see him.
Well, you can see him twice as much, and
right.
Maybe it'll help.
Third was Mississippi, tied for fourth was Rhode Island and South Dakota. Again, these rural states apparently will get their at-risk people in to see a doctor better than a state that's predominantly urban, but that's about it. We have the thing that killed us, again, was the highest cancer rate. We have the highest cancer rate in the nation. We have the third highest heart disease rate in the nation. It killed our outcomes, which brought us down to 36. Other than that, we were looking at a top 20 ranking overall for our healthcare system, but our outcomes are just abysmal. Means that we have to change our lifestyle, means that we have to do something about the smoking and the things that Rick mentioned that seem to be bringing us down. Meanwhile, we have to take a break. We're going to give you a break as well. Come back and listen to our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Bye Bye Boydie Show.
Bye Bye.
As we somehow wish good riddance to bad rubbish in the words
another
of Elmer Fudd.
Right.
To yet another producer of Health Matters, Tanner Boyd. Rest in peace.
You think we can get him to put Another One Bites the Dust in there? You think he would do that for us?
It would be a good soft news feature, for instance, for the program. I think he's apparently pretty
and
good
really,
at that.
Frankly, we don't care how much work he has to do on this last show, right? We don't care.
Do it, Tanner, or we're walking. Our sponsor for the second time, the Society for Etiquette in the Clinic. Patience is a virtue, but no doctor wants virtual patients. 9 questions, according to Time Magazine, your doctor wishes you would ask. And we went through 4 last time. What are my different treatment options? What outcomes should I expect from this surgery or this treatment? Do we have to do it now, or can we wait till later? And 4, is there anything I can do on my own to improve the condition? We're up to number 5. What are the side effects? And this would be of this treatment or of this condition. It's important to ask those things. Now, you can take – I know you are rushed. You can, and as far as a medication goes, you can ask the pharmacist about the side effects. The problem is you've already made the decision somewhat together to go ahead with that medication by the time it gets to the pharmacist. So it is kind of important to ask what are the main side effects of this medication, because it may involve something that is very important to you. If the side effects of this medication are that it can make you drowsy in the morning, and you are an early riser and you like to get to work and you need to really need your full brain capacity in the morning, that's not going to work. I remember a guy who had high blood pressure, and I treated him with an adrenaline blocker. He got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. He was a construction supervisor, started yelling at people. He was a very aggressive kind of guy, meeting deadlines, and an adrenaline blocker was just the wrong choice for him. We did not discuss that enough beforehand. I would have known an adrenaline blocker was the wrong choice for him. 6, how will I hear about my test results? And I tell my patients, you know, I don't like the idea of if you don't hear anything, it's probably okay. Most hospitals and clinics now have a portal where you can go online,
right?
And they want you to go online and check on your results
because they want you to spend as much time on the computer as they have to be.
Well, actually, they get to they're trying to demonstrate to the federal government that they are giving patients access, and they have to get a certain percent of their patients online. So they will certainly encourage this. But one way or the other, whether it's online, whether it is some type of secure message, whether it is a phone call, whether you can call in for the results, find out how you're going to get the results. And if I were getting a test, I would in fact find some way to check. I would find a way. Either I could call in or get something from them. I would not be satisfied with, well, if you don't hear anything, it's probably okay. Number 7, how much will this cost me? You know, that is a very tough question to ask. The prices that doctors and hospitals set for procedures were prices they used to negotiate with insurance companies,
right,
who did not pay those prices. So how much will this cost me depends upon what type of insurance you have, just pure and simple. There are varying prices for varying insurance companies.
I would have said it's fuzzy math, but really it's soft math.
Yeah, I think we'll continue with the idea of soft. This is a soft feature here, and this is soft math. But the truth of the matter is, I would have a difficult time. I would know exactly to the penny what the procedure, what the billing for the procedure was, but the different insurance companies have different discounts on it. And so, in fact, I would not know, and that would be something we'd have to go to billing. But it is a legitimate question, and we're trying to go to price transparency, so somehow we're going to have to actually come down to costs, how much it costs you to get a certain test done. Number 8, this is a tough one. Should I get a second opinion?
Yes.
Tanner, should I get a second opinion?
You just did.
Okay, I'm sorry. No, but that's a tough one.
But it's only tough when it's not life-threatening, maybe?
I don't know. Your doctor says, I believe you should do this. And you said, well, should I get a second opinion? It's like, well, you know, is there a trust there? Do you mistrust the doctor?
So, Tony, this is a good opportunity to lay something out there. You know, look, I have always felt like it's a good idea to get a second opinion. I think where the second opinion goes off the rails and falls apart is when you go to get that second opinion and that second opinion tries to keep you as a patient. You know, that's the problem. If you go get a second opinion, be loyal to your first, especially if the second opinion agrees with your first physician. Go back to your first physician and have it done. Right. So I think the problem I see with a second opinion is from a physician standpoint, you'll lose patients.
I think the other way, and this is mentioned in the text, and this makes more sense to me, should I see a specialist for this condition? I think that's a legitimate question to ask your doctor. Do you feel comfortable managing this? Should I see a specialist? Now, that's as a non-surgeon. Rick is speaking as a surgeon. Should you get a second opinion regarding surgery? And then if you do, well, then have the courtesy, if the second opinion agrees, to go back to the physician that you consulted originally. Yeah. I understand what you're saying. I'm not saying that you should be loyal to someone you don't like, but be aware that if a surgeon sends you for a second opinion from another surgeon, and the second surgeon agrees with the first surgeon, then there is a matter of etiquette there as well. You don't take patients away from another doctor.
But it happens. It happens fairly regularly.
Yeah. So two questions, then. We agree in primary care, the question, should I see a specialist or do you feel comfortable with this, is a fair question. Should I see another person for this condition who has the same expertise as you? In a primary care sense, as an internist or family physician, that's a little strange. As a surgeon, a second opinion, since you're about to have surgery, is more common, but please have consideration for the first surgeon when you see the second surgeon. And then number nine, and this is the third wish. You know, you rub the bottle and you get the third wish. What questions haven't I asked that I should have asked? That's like, well, I want infinite more wishes. Okay, so here's a question for you. What's another question I should ask? But by the same token, it gives me a moment to think about the things that you might need to know about the condition. It's not a bad way to frame it, I think, in terms of having a conversation with your doctor. That is our sponsor, the Society for Etiquette in the Clinic. Patience is a virtue, but no doctor wants virtual patients. Time Magazine's 9 questions you should ask your doctor. Rick, this was a strange thing that happened to me. I am always fretting over things that I did when I was early in my practice that have subsequently, by research, been found to be wrong. You go back and you realize, gee, I didn't treat people the way I should have when I started. Not because I didn't read or because I didn't try, but because medical science had not caught up to the correct answer on that question. So I was reading in New Scientist magazine. This is just a general science journal written for lay people who have a scientific leaning. And they had something called Misguided Medicine, saying too many treatments are overturned because they never worked in the first place. And their point is there is a mad dash toward money when a new treatment comes out. It is on patent or it is new, and a company has sunk a lot of money into it and wants to get their money back, so we need to get this treatment accepted and used fairly rapidly. We'll see that over and over and over again. There are sometimes studies that are misleading, and future research corrects the initial misperception, but for whatever reason, sometimes we do something and then we wind up deciding that that's the wrong thing to do. So they have 10 major reversals, and we got about 10 minutes left or so, and so I thought, well, let's look at these 10 major reversals and talk with them some. One is something number one here for them is something I have mentioned repeatedly on this show as being one of the great regrets of my career, and that's hormone replacement therapy. At the time I was trained and started my medical practice, best care for a postmenopausal woman was to start her on hormone replacement. Celebrities endorsed it. Scientific studies with the Women's Health Initiative seemed to indicate that it was beneficial.
It sounded right.
Yeah, these are observational studies, and that was the mistake, as we based our practice on observational studies. Given to millions of people in the 1990s and 2002, increases risk of breast cancer. Honestly, of course. It's hard to remember that there was a time when we didn't think that it was going to increase your risk of breast cancer, but it does, and also heart disease and stroke, so it has been discontinued. Now, in certain circumstances, for severe menopausal symptoms or for other reasons, we still use estrogen, but for the most part, we used it extensively, and then we stopped, and that was a reversal, and we caused harm with this, as best we can tell, in many people. Now, there's still people who argue about this. They say, well, you know, I don't think we used the right dose, or we selected our patients right. You know, if you're going to, as a healthy person, take something every day, it needs to really be good.
Coffee.
Yeah, fair enough.
Show me one piece of evidence that suggests coffee's bad for you.
And it
it's
helps
only been
you,
around like 5,000 years.
And it helps you focus, and it helps you get work done, and there's a
and
real
clearly
reason.
I don't drink it before the show.
For a health person, for a healthy person to drink coffee. That's a great example. And the same way, exercise, that's fairly simple. Now, when you start taking pills, it gets a little more complicated. We know now that vitamins are no good. Vitamins just should not be taken. A multivitamin doesn't do anything and may actually worsen your health.
But it's good. It's like a placebo. It's good.
Well,
right?
You think
it's
I'm trying to do something. Sure, and I don't want to really eat
good food.
Kale, for instance. So what am I going to do? Or grapefruit. Yeah. What am I going to do? I'll just
but
take a
But you really don't want to eat grapefruit and kale.
No, I don't like grapefruit. I did not pick those out at random. Those are two things that I really don't like.
Uh-oh. Now, see, now you've just caused grapefruit problems for us. And usually it's I'm the one who tells how bad I like
grapefruit. Just saying, if you're going to do something every day, it needs to be of known benefit.
I spent 4 days in the state of Florida, never even sniffed a grapefruit.
I'm proud of you, buddy.
It was fabulous.
I'm proud of you. Number two. And by the way, we're just rocketing along here. It's top 10. Number two, peanut allergies. Now, this one I think most people are aware of.
We reversed that?
We reversed it. I mean, there was our rates of peanut allergy were increasing rapidly. You know that. I mean, we started to the point where preschool airlines got rid of their peanuts. Other places no longer serve peanut butter because the rate of life-threatening reactions to peanuts increased. And without really being able to study that very much, pediatricians decided, well, maybe we just shouldn't expose kids to peanuts. It's too dangerous to expose them to peanuts. Well, it turns out, finally, we studied this, and in 2015, figured out that early exposure to peanut butter and to peanut spread and to peanut products actually lowers risk of allergies rather than raising them. So we have been advising parents to keep peanuts away from their kids, and now we realize that introducing peanuts early. Now, if your child has peanut allergies, please don't give them peanuts. That would be really bad. But for most infants, actually getting them started on peanut butter or some type of peanut products early on may lower their risk of peanut allergies rather than raising. Number three.
Hey, it's only been like 4 minutes.
I know. Keyhole surgery for our arthritis of the knee. There's something called osteoarthritis, wear and tear arthritis on the knees. It does tear the cartilage. And so we used to go in with a scope and fish the little fragments of cartilage out. We figured that that would, if the cartilage wasn't bits and pieces of it around in the knee joint, it would make people better. Maybe it would help improve motion, reduce inflammation, and so forth. Back in the early 2000s, 650,000 surgeries per year. But then it didn't work. It just did not seem to have any benefits for osteoarthritis, and it has fallen off. It is still being done, but I think that's, again, this was a lay magazine. I think they're perhaps maybe overstating their case because it's not that the surgery itself is of no value in any circumstance. It's the routine removal of bits and pieces of cartilage doesn't seem to improve the outcomes in knee osteoarthritis. Their number four was cancer screening, you know, and they mentioned specifically about mammograms and the PSA test for prostate cancer. You may remember PSA test for prostate cancer. We were diagnosing prostate cancer at many times the rate of European countries.
Sure.
And we were curing it all.
Right.
And we created a massive amount of prostate
Success.
Cancer survivors who went to Relay for Life and spoke out about the importance of screening that they were a cancer survivor. Turns out the 5-year survival rate for prostate cancer is 99% anyway. And so, in fact, we were finding and operating on a number of things that were never going to cause anyone any harm, but we would find it and take it out anyway. We probably caused more harm than we
With complications,
helped.
Right?
Yeah, with
sure.
surgical complications. And so we decided not to offer routine PSA to people at average risk. Now, if you're above average risk, you have a family member that had prostate cancer at a young age. If you're African American, that's a whole different matter. But for routine people, we no longer recommend PSA automatically. It is something you discuss with your doctor, assess your risk. Same way with mammograms. We were picking up a lot of things that probably were not going to turn into metastatic deadly cancer. And we changed our mammogram recommendations, raised the starting age from age 40 to age 50. Although some people still feel that 40 is indicated. And the legislature said, well, if you want to do 40, you can. The insurance companies have to pay for it. If you are at average risk, you don't have a first-degree relative with breast cancer or breast cancer at a young age, it's currently the starting age is recommended at 50. And so you see, I mean, you look back over that, millions of people treated with estrogens, people having arthritis surgery for their knee, people having cancer screening procedures and so forth. It's embarrassing. The peanut allergy, how many allergic reactions did we cause by the fact that we didn't know that early introduction to peanuts would be a good thing? There's all these things are, this is not a minor thing at all. Number five, heart stents. First of all, let me say to our radio fans, heart stents, where you go in with a catheter and put the stent in place to prop open an artery, that works really well. It is a good thing. It has practically put the bypass surgery people out of business. However, using heart stents in people with no symptoms just to prop an artery open doesn't seem to help. So if you have chest pain, they are very good at relieving chest pain. It can save you having to have bypass surgery, but we don't go in just because we see something on the heart catheterization and start propping everything open. It has to be in some way related to your symptoms or we won't do it. Six is really interesting. This was something called vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty.
A definition, please.
Yeah. This was something where if your spine collapsed, you had the brittle bones in your spine collapsed, they would go back in and they would put some cement in there to stabilize the spine. spine. They would inject it in with a needle.
Sounds like a good idea.
You know, I mean, let's face it. If your outbuilding or your shed collapses, you're going to go back in and shore up the pole and keep the thing from falling over.
My shed only moves in a thunderstorm. It's putting cement in a back. A back moves, right?
Well, parts of it do. If you think about it, you're...
Not the part they cement.
Well, that's certainly not going to move. But what you've got, if you think about it, you've got bones, and then you've got those discs in between bones. And the bones themselves will flex back and forth, but the bone doesn't wobble.
Yeah, but when I flex my concrete porch, it cracks.
All right, Rick, your body is composed of bones, and they're connected by ligaments, and they have discs in between them.
And there's no cement in there anywhere.
But the bone is made out of calcium. That's not a flexible thing. You can't wobble your arm. You can move it at the elbow.
So why'd they reverse it then, Smarty Pants?
Okay, well, here's the thing. All right, so this is really interesting. I'm glad you asked that because, this thing was, we thought, well, this would reduce pain and it would help stabilize your spine if the bones themselves were not crunchy and sliding from side to side. By 2009, 750,000 operations per year. Two studies in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that it was not beneficial, and so we stopped. But here's the rub. I just presented this to the hospital. Those studies had people wait for between 9 weeks and a year to see if they would get better on their own before they actually did it. Now, there's a new study out in The Lancet that just reported in August that indicates if you get to people early and put the cement in, you stabilize the spine, and it appears you do have some benefit. So the problem is, some of these things are really complicated. Heart stents, it depends upon why you put them in. They can be very, very beneficial, or they can have no benefit if you just stick them in because you saw
They can just be very expensive.
Yeah, they can just be expensive. Vertebroplasty, again, this journal, lay magazine says don't do it. The Lancet says, this could be a good thing if we get to it a little quicker than we did before. And that's always been the thing. Did we do enough? Did we do it soon enough? Did we wait too long? All those things you've got to ask about a procedure that seems like it might work. Number seven, intensive lowering of blood sugar for adults with diabetes. This was something that we were trying to get them low, try to get them normal sugars, and we were driving the sugar down too low. And if it's a teenager, it's one thing, but if this is a person in their 60s or 70s, that low sugar can really hurt them. We have backed off a little bit from that really tight control of sugar, especially in adults who live alone. I'll skip a couple because we got just about a minute left.
But Tony, you can go through lots of things in a minute. You always do.
Well, all right. Number eight was screening embryos for older women doing in vitro fertilization. I have no expertise at all in this. They just mentioned genetic screening should reduce pregnancy failure because you could figure out whether the embryo was viable or not. Turns out when you screen it, you actually make the embryo less viable. So don't poke the embryo is the word. Number nine, dropping your body temperature when you do aneurysm surgery. The idea, again, was if you lower the metabolism by cooling the body, it would work better. It didn't. Number 10, and again, another complicated thing, ear tube surgery, putting tubes in the ears of people with a persistent infection. A review in 2014 found no adverse effect if surgery is delayed. And then they said, but the surgery is still common. Well, I think, again, they were overstating their case. The surgery is common because it is delayed. There have been some guidelines on putting tubes in, and you don't do it for the first ear infection. You do it if there's persistent fluid behind the ears or the child's having difficulty hearing. Those are the reasons for tubes. So I'm actually okay on that, but we probably overdid that. As well as, you remember tonsil surgery when I was young. Everybody got their tonsils out. And so we've worked hard on ears and throats, and not necessarily it's always paid off. There you go. We got through a 20-minute segment talking about medical mistakes. I feel good about it. It's off my chest.
Tanner's only got one more to go.
Take a break, and we'll be back for Tanner's final segment. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and Tanner's final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Bye Bye Boy D Show.
How many times have we said goodbye? Too many to count. In 650-plus shows?
We've said goodbye to a lot of people, too. That's the other thing.
Well, a lot of people said goodbye to us, too.
Revolving door situation we got here. Yep, that's true. But we do wish Tanner well as he starts an actual paying career.
Yeah.
He is at a healthcare facility, but I know... By the way, we'll just go ahead, Tanner, if someone were to offer a substantial amount of money to produce radio shows, to be on air, I think you could probably get Tanner Boyd to give up his current position. He also is interested in media and public and promotion and marketing. And does, as you could tell from this show, does a pretty decent job, because Rick and I often come in here just completely unable to speak.
Right.
And he somehow turns it into a show that ends on time.
I don't know how many mms he cuts out every show, but right. It has to be in the hundreds. And for you ladies, I understand he does like long moonlight walks and on the beach. So just I'm just saying, if
no
you happen
where
to
you're headed with that.
If you just happen to bump into him, he
oh,
might
so
be
we're
going to
get him. We're going to. I think Tanner is in a relationship right now.
Oops.
It is relatively serious. Okay, so we're all right. So
that
he's
joke
saying
won't fly
his
with some
girlfriend
people.
Doesn't listen to the show, so we're back on. At any rate, but we could get him a job in a radio or in promotions.
I'm just assuring he never comes
that.
Back.
All right, our sponsor for the final time is the Society for Etiquette in the Clinic. Patience is a virtue, but no doctor wants virtual patients. The 9 questions, according to Time Magazine, your doctor wants you to ask. 1, what are the different treatment options? 2, what outcomes should I expect from this medicine or this surgery or this course of therapy? 3, do we have to do it now or can it wait? And again, if it's something that you're not sure that you want to pursue, you could ask your physician. Many times I have scheduled things because it seemed to be bothering my patient, not because I was concerned that it was a threat to life and limb. 4, is there anything I can do on my own? Oh my goodness, what a great question to help this condition. 5, what are the side effects? And again, although you can get that information from your pharmacist, by that time the decision has been made to use this medication, it might be nice to talk to your doctor up front and ask them if what are the major side effects and make sure that they're not things that would be absolutely devastating to you. 6, how will I hear about my test results? Be sure you ask that question. How do you access that information? I think in this day and age, the idea that no news is good news is simply not satisfactory for a test. I think that every patient should have the ability to access their test results, and many clinics and hospitals have portals where you can find out about your medical record and your test results, and I encourage you to ask your care provider about that. 7, how much will it cost? Good luck on that one. Again, medical costs have been used as negotiating chips with insurance companies who then negotiate a very steep discount. The actual price will vary depending on the insurance company, and that will be a very difficult question for your doctor to answer. They should be able to refer you to someone. You should be able to get that answer before you leave the clinic, but it's going to take some work. 8, should I get a second opinion? That is, either should do you think I need to see a specialist for this, or do you feel comfortable with it? Or in the case of a surgery, do I need a second opinion about whether or not this surgery would be worthwhile, or what are my other options? Both of those we think are reasonable if asked properly. 9, what questions have I not asked? And that just seems to me to be a cop-out. That is like wishing for infinite wishes with your last wish. I think, it gives you a chance to talk a little bit more with your doctor. As our sponsor, the Society for Etiquette in the Clinic, with the 9 questions for patients to ask their doctor. I want to finish off on, we talked about some of the things that had been reversed, things like not eating peanuts early in life to avoid peanut allergy, treating postmenopausal women with estrogens, using those heart stents widely for anybody who had a narrowed artery rather than focusing on the narrowed arteries that seem to be causing symptoms, things like that. There was also August 30th this year, published in the AMA Journal of Internal Medicine, some things about what they call low-value care services. And they looked at the records of 1.5 million patients ages 18 to 64 years, and they look for what they call low-value services, things that we know are not that useful. Now, these are not things that have been reversed, not things that are historical oddities. These are things that are going on right now. $32.8 million for these 1.5 million patients, so obviously a significant amount of unnecessary spending there. And this was commercially insured patients, 2013, and it was 1.5 million patients. The most commonly received not very useful tests were imaging, mainly a CAT scan for an uncomplicated headache. I come in, I say my head hurts. Yeah, it's like it was last time. No, I've not passed out. I've not had any changes in my vision. Same headache I've had. Well, let's get a CAT scan to be sure it's not a brain tumor. About 1% of all people wind up having a CAT scan for pretty much a run-of-the-mill headache, which turns out to offer no useful information. And this is going to recur again and again. 1.3% of people had imaging for non-specific low back pain. I can't tell you how many people come into the office office specifically to get an x-ray for their back pain. Most people want an MRI scan now. It used to be plain films. Now it's an MRI scan. And we don't do well with back pain. We were talking about that during the break. Back pain is a very difficult condition for people to treat. The medications don't work very well. Rick mentions surgery doesn't work that well. I mentioned the bone cement works in some circumstances with these crush fractures, compression fractures we call them, but not certainly for routine back pain. Shoring up the bones with cement doesn't work at all for that. And we get a lot of unnecessary MRI scans. And then the most common thing is measuring too many blood tests for people with low thyroid hormone level. It's a fairly common condition. There is a certain test that we get called a TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. That's all you need, but people will put it into a thyroid panel. Now, the highest spending by far was, I'll say the two highest spending levels. One is getting the MRI scans for nonspecific low back pain. Now, with back pain, if you have back pain and signs of cancer, I should check for cancer. If you have a back pain and high fever and signs of infection, I should look to see if you have an infection in your spine. If you can't move your leg, I should look to see if it's damaging your nerves. Now, the rest of back pain is what we call nonspecific back pain. We don't know what causes it. It appears to be a part of the back structures. We know that in general it does pretty well over time and that we can't seem to improve what it does. Getting an MRI scan, then, if you don't have some of those warning signs, $3.1 million of their $32 million was just spent on imaging the back pain. And same way with the CAT scans for headaches, that was $3.6 million. And then spinal injections for lower back pain, $12 million. And again, with very little evidence that they produce a lasting benefit.
Gosh, Tony, just talking about the back like that, just, ooh.
Back pain is tricky. Like, and back pain is quite expensive.
Yeah, and I don't know, just all around, that's the whole idea. That's why the joke in the second fractional portion of back, your back and cement just sounds wrong.
Here's your back with cement.
Right.
Again, well, if you think about, if those bones collapsed, then shoring up those bones is a pretty good idea. I mean, let's face it, if your arm collapsed, you would go get it pinned and rotted and all those sort of things to try to make that arm good. I don't know why you're focusing on the spine bones. If they collapse, why not put some cement in there and keep them from collapsing further?
Well, because they collapse because of what's in between them.
No, the bone itself, boom, it just
squishes.
It crunches down. And this is sometimes if you were to fall from a height, a young or middle-aged person, it will collapse, and that bone will then be that little bone, which looks sort of like it looks like a biscuit, I guess you would say, becomes a pancake.
Nice.
Yeah. So
that really sounds like a good use for cement.
Yeah, you put the cement really in there, and you make the pancake into a biscuit.
Yeah, because you've got to go in and get to it to do that.
With a needle.
I'm going to form a biscuit with a needle.
I'm going to put cement in around the remainder of that bone. It's not going to go all the way back to a biscuit, but it's going to be a fluffy pancake. How about that?
It sounds to me like it's going to be like some kind of crazy waffle that I've fixed.
Waffle. I like that. So this is why you're waffling on the surgery,
exactly.
Because you don't know if you want a waffle in your back.
No.
But honestly, other bones, when you break a bone, when it collapses down, you try to restore it using rods and mechanical devices to try to restore it to where it was. It has some appeal. Now, let me say before I oversell it, if you wait 9 weeks or so, the majority of these, at least half of them, will get better on their own. And if you wait very long, it doesn't appear that it works. That's the studies that really doomed this procedure. What they're saying now is, well, but if you pick people up at around 3 to 6 weeks, you give them a chance to heal and
that's
the pain gets better on its own.
Most success.
That's when you have the most success with the cement, maybe. Now, again, it's a new study. It needs a little time to sort of percolate before we decide what we're going to do with it. But I just think that vertebroplasty, putting cement in the back, is not necessarily a thing that is going to be no longer done. I think in certain circumstances it may be beneficial. Next up, I got a couple of studies, Rick, that were interesting, but I don't think they're very well done. These are observational studies, and observational studies always run into problems. And again, the chief problem with the observational study is you don't control the environment. When you do an observational study, you observe some characteristic, and then you might draw conclusions about that. And the classic example is NBA basketball players wear big shoes. It is not true that if I started wearing big shoes, I could play in the NBA.
You could.
Not with big shoes, not with small shoes.
You might be able to play in the D League. I've seen you. You can dunk.
Donuts. But you can see the problem with that. Yes, those basketball players, this is a characteristic of professional basketball players. They have big shoes. But that characteristic does not something that other people can do. So,
is that like saying everybody with a white coat's a doctor?
Yeah, well, it would be the same thing. People who are, I don't know, you know, people who score well on tests wear white coats. Possibly true, but it doesn't mean that you can score better on a test by wearing a white coat.
People who listen to Health Matters are better off for it?
I don't know. We haven't studied that. All right, let me get to this thing here. This was published in, and these are not the highest ranked journals, but this was Social Science and Medicine.
This was a slow news day for you.
It was a British journal. This just was interesting. The question, and I was looking at something else, and I just saw this thing, and I thought, let's get it on the show. Is physical activity in natural environments better for mental health than physical activity in other environments? So you got this thing. You could go for a walk in the woods.
Right.
Or you could walk on a treadmill under fluorescent lights with a TV set blaring out techno music.
Right.
Now, which one of those is going to be best for your mental health? Well, I mean, the way I set it
up.
The
woods.
Yeah, the woods, of course.
Of course, as long as you're not night and dark and, you know. As long as you don't have some safety issues to deal with.
Well, now that's the thing right there. Because we talk about walking for your health. I still remember when I was a resident in Richmond, Virginia, I recommended to one of my patients, I said, you should walk more. That would help your sugar and help your blood pressure. Turns out there was a young man murdered in front of her apartment complex just the week before. So that was a very stupid suggestion on my part, that she walk more because her environment was not safe. So you actually have hit on the problem I have with this study, is that if you have...
I have that uncanny ability.
I hate you. All right, so let's go with this right here. It was an observational study.
I'm not leaving like Tanner.
Yeah, it used data from the Scottish Health Survey 2008 describing environments in which the respondents were physically active. And they looked for associations between the environments and their level of mental health. Now, these environments, they had a bunch of different places. And this sounds like one of those old computer programs. You're in a woodland, a forest, or a tree-covered park, an open space, a country path, a beach or seashore.
Walk to the east.
A loch or river. Of course, we don't do lochs here in the United States. Sports fields, swimming pool, gym, pavement or streets in the local area. And obviously, you could walk through town or run through town.
So here's the thing, Tony. What do you think about walking on your treadmill in a virtual reality environment?
Well,
what if it was a nice, safe woods?
Right.
Where there was beautiful sunlight and animals sitting in the trees, and it was very, you know.
Well, if you would just shut up, I'll finish this study, and then this will explain what I think about it, okay?
I don't think you think much of it.
Well, now I've got you defensive, but let's go ahead with this. Results showed an independent association between regular use of natural environments and a lower risk for poor mental health, but not for activity in other environments. In other words, if you did techno treadmill, your mental health is not as good as if you walked through the woods.
Sure.
Greater physical activity in natural environments is associated with reduced risk and the poor mental health to a greater extent than physical activity in other environments. Access to natural environments for physical activity should be protected and promoted. And so there we go. But again, it's an observational study. My point relates to what you just said and to what my patient told me back when I was in Richmond, Virginia. If you have access to a natural environment, you are a wealthier person.
Right.
If you
have a safe natural environment.
Right, right. That is, you have a higher socioeconomic status, probably a higher educational status. You can do that. And I think the same thing would go for virtual reality. If we did an observational study, people who could afford to buy virtual reality and employ that in their exercise, they're going to have better mental health because they can afford the virtual reality. Now, if we actually started giving virtual reality sessions to people who have low socioeconomic status, low educational level, I don't think it would hold up. And certainly not to the point that we I mean, there's a great reason to protect green space. There's a lot of reasons for that. But I don't think this study made a strong one. You see my point?
No.
All right, same thing. Let me give you the second one here. This was from Social Science and Medicine. This is the one I actually went after in that journal, and this was July of 2016. This was association of book reading with longevity. They had 3,600 participants in a national health and retirement study who provided information about their reading patterns, and then they followed them for 12 years. There was a survival advantage for book reading. You were 20% less likely to die over 12 years if you read books. And that was adjusted for your wealth, your marital status, for depression. Still, book reading, any type of book reading, was better than magazines, better than newspapers, and I assume better than virtual book reading, although you can ask that same question again. Now, Rick, in my lifetime, I have experienced changes in my vision. I became farsighted. I became presbyopic. I have old eyes, and I wear reading glasses now.
Okay.
There were times in my life when I did not enjoy reading, and I cut back on it substantially.
Okay.
Because it was unpleasant to read.
Right.
And
I did the same thing with running.
Right. I think Well, in the same way, you know, if you can't read or if you can't run, then that says something about your health, and I don't think they adjusted for that. So I as much as I want to believe that reading books gives you a survival advantage over 12 years, I think being able to read books may be the more important thing.
Right.
Being able to go to a natural environment to exercise may be the important thing. If you have the ability to read and you have the wherewithal to get to a natural environment, you already have that survival advantage, and you just actualize that by doing those things.
Right.
Okay.
So, and then that is an observational study.
That is an observational study. Can you observe us off the air?
One last special thanks to our departing Morehead State Public Radio producer, Tanner Boyd, and to Eric Bilbrey, not his last time, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And listen to this letter we received from the U.S. Senate, which is very similar to the one they wrote regarding the EpiPen price increases.
We are writing today to express our concern with the repeated and significant price increases for Health Matters and to request information about Health Matters' efforts to increase access to your show by expanding your listener assistance program.
Health Matters has become so exorbitantly expensive that access to this life-saving radio show is in jeopardy for many Americans. As of May 2016, Health Matters has increased its price by over 480%.
Some Americans who are unable to afford this cost increase have resorted to carrying previous versions of your show or carry no Health Matters at all. Health Matters has a near monopoly on the health radio show market, and this has allowed you to increase prices well beyond those that are justified.
At the same time, your company moved its tax address to the Netherlands to avoid paying its fair share of corporate taxes. I mean, how low can you get?
Right.
Tony Weaver's reported compensation increase over 670% in the past 8 years. Well, no, you're not the host, Rick.
Apparently. Health Matters has responded to concerns about the high cost of your show by arguing that your accessibility programs ensure consumer access to your product despite the high cost. Your discount programs, however, represent a well-defined industry tactic to keep costs high for a complex shell game. Interest, insurance companies, the government, and employers still bear the burden of the excessive prices of your show. In turn, those costs are eventually passed on to consumers.
That's right, a complex shell game. Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down, and don't resort to using expired Health Matters shows. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for the first episode of our generic Health Matters, which costs half as much as the current show on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.